Where that that gets us to the 70s. Could you maybe take us through to
right during the as I say, were very lean times. By 1970, I went on the executive board in 1970, in the fall of 1970, and I had started to grow up a little bit or mature, settle down. Wasn't quite as crazy as I was
when
I was on a third shift. I guess it happens eventually to most people. I had myself going back to school. I had a GI Bill, and I had my I graduated from Sacred Heart University, got a bachelor's degree in 1975. But I stayed on at the with the union and the bar union. I was, in, as I say, on the executive board as the recording secretary.
Okay, if I could just interrupt there for a second.
Sure.
That means you were a full-time union employee at that point?
No, I was an employee. I was employed by the company. I got my paycheck from the company, except for times we would have to, we had offices outside the, off the premises, but the union had its own offices. So when I was, be cleared out on what we call lost time, and the union would pay for that time.
Okay, sure. So,
but I was still, all this time I had been, I'm
employee.
Still, as of today, I'm still an employee of the company.
Okay.
Which is more or less typical. Although, when I'm in the plant now as a recording secretary on the executive board, my duties are such and responsibilities are such that I'm full-time in the plant, full-time at union business, because I was dealing with pensions. I was on the pension board administration. I handled the benefits, kind of like a benefit representative.
Oh, okay. Sure.
And we had more and more retirees now. By 1976, we had about 600 or 700 retirees, and today we have about 1,500. We have a pretty large group of retirees. But the there was very no jobs at all. There were a lot of people who were on short work weeks during that period for several years. A lot of them had short-term layoffs where they might work 2 or 3 months out of a whole year. They were laid off, recalled, constantly laid off and recalled. The recall rights last for 2 years after the date that you're laid off. So you get recalled, you can come back, and you have all your seniority and all your service and your the only thing you don't get is that time away on a layoff for, towards your pension. So at any rate, during the mid 1975, the company was developing a new engine for the Army tanks. And the Chrysler Corporation won the competition to build a new Abrams, the main Army tank, main battle tank for the Army, and we got the exclusive contract to make the engines in 1976. So that began then a turnaround. So starting in the late 1977, 78, the company started, the layoff stopped, the company started recall and rehiring people. And the plant was busy. And it was owned, it was very busy up until primarily on tank production until the late 1990s, 1990, 1991, when it started laying off again. For the first 25 years, Avco and later Textron and did not have any commercial products. It just was exclusive military products. In the late 1970s, Avco Corporation had developed a commercial version of the engine it made. And it worked out an arrangement with the Army, because the plant is a big plant, it's a 2 million square foot plant, Stratford South End. It's actually owned by the Army. It used to be owned by the Navy during World War II. Then when it was reopened in 1951, it was an Air Force plant. And then when they went into tank production in 1978, the Army took it over and they called it the Stratford Army Engine Plant. But and the commercial operators were that they were just what just that they operated the plant for the military. In 1979, as I say, they started developing commercial engines. They started in this very slow period in the early 1970s. They started selling some of the helicopters to commercial, like logging companies, places like that. So they did start to get a small commercial market. They worked out an arrangement with Avco, worked out an arrangement with the Army to pay the Army rent And eventually it got to about $4 or $5 million a year was to use the Army's facility and the Army's equipment to make commercial products. So there was some that had a tendency, we hoped that that would stabilize, you know, smooth out some of the peaks and valleys of being exclusively a military contractor. And so during the height of the tank production, which was probably in the late 1980s, the plant was producing about 120 tank engines a month, as well as a variety of other engines for other military and commercial operations. Then, one of the things about the company, let me tell you a little bit about the company.
Sure.
The company, Avco Corporation, was run out of Greenwich, Connecticut, where their corporate headquarters was. They got involved two or three times, they got hit by this green mail, where some investors would come and bought a small percentage of the stock, about 5% of the stock. This was in a common practice during the late 1970s, early 1980s. And Irwin Jacobs, or an investment group in California called Leucadia, bought about 5% of the Avco stock. And they threatened to buy out the corporation. The Avco Corporation panicked. They bought the stock back. And this investment, these speculators made about $50 million on that. This happened twice within about a year and a half. In 1984, what happened, Textron Corporation, Providence, Rhode Island, another conglomerate, bought out the entire Avco Corporation. And this was sort of a white knight to try to, because there was another group that had just made a run at Avco Corporation. They made about a $50 million profit. They also had an agreement that if the company was sold at a higher stock price within a year, that they would get the difference, the premium. So they ended up getting about another $50 million for nothing after Textron bought the business. So in 1984, the company was taken over by Textron Corporation. Nothing changed. The contract, they recognized the contract. Everything was pretty much the same, except the corporate office now was in Providence, Rhode Island, rather than Greenwich, Connecticut. And Textron owned and operated the business until 1994, for 10 years, when it finally sold the business, not the plant, but the business, to Allied Signal, Allied Signal Engines. And that was the beginning of the end for us, a very sorry chapter. I'll tell you a little bit about that. What happened in 19, we knew, well, it all started actually with the change in the international relations with the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, because the Army up to that time could not get enough tank engines. We couldn't make them fast enough. You know, they looked at the military planners, looked at Warsaw Pact, and they said, whoa, my God, those commies, they've got 60 or 70,000 tanks, and we only have 5,000, so we need more tanks.
Yeah.
And so, as I say, the Army couldn't get enough tanks, and they were planning to build a next generation. They were already even a better tank. You know, they always have on the drawing boards the future models of military weapons. And so it looked like there was going to be a long-term secure future there. And that all changed began to change with the decline of the fall of the Berlin Wall, in the end, the military threat in Europe. The Army, the Congress started cutting back on the budget, and we and the Union were trying to push management to focus more on the commercial work, to try to stabilize employment there. During the peak production of tank engines, the Army, because it owned the plant, they were able to dictate the production schedule. They said, our engines are a priority. And once you get our engines built and delivered every month, then if you want to make commercial engines, that's fine. And the plant was always at a production deficit. In other words, they were always panicking and running at the end of the month to try to meet their quotas for the month. So it was, when the Army works in response, what the company did to try to, the Army was threatening to take away the, develop a second source for this tank engine.
Oh, okay.
And that would have been, that would have been, hurt the business and caused a lot more layoffs. So it was a big political fight with the congressional delegation of Connecticut to try to stop the Army from developing a second source for tank engines. And the union and the company joined together. Obviously, we were looking for jobs and they wanted to keep the business. And we lobbied with them in Washington. And one of the things that the company had to agree to was to offload, to send out all the commercial work. So all they did was they did the assembly and the test of the engines, but the manufacture of those commercial engines was done at all around the country by little vendors around the country. And so it was our feeling now, as this work, the tank work started to slow down, that the company should start to reload this commercial work and to take the slack.
Okay, sure.
1994, we had mass layoffs started again in 1992. We had perhaps the union never did get back up to its our peak during the Vietnam. We got the plant went up to about 7,000 employees, and usually it was about 50-50. We had the the peak of Local 1010 was about 2,800 members. That was in the mid 1980s, and then gradually the layoffs began. And then in the 91-92 time frame, they began to really accelerate, where we got into mass layoffs again, several hundred, or perhaps even almost 1,000 Local 1010 bargaining employees. But they, we went into negotiations in 1994 with Textron Corporation, and there was a lot of speculation what's going to happen to the company. With the midway through negotiations, the contract expired in May 30th. On May the, of 1994, on May the 12th, or May the 11th, there was an announcement that Allied Signal and Textron Corporation had signed a memorandum of understanding that would eventually lead to the acquisition, if all things went well for both corporations, it would lead to the acquisition of the business by Allied Signal Engines. Textron said, we want to get out of the business, and Allied said, well, this is compatible with our business. We have another aircraft engine manufacturing plant in Phoenix, Arizona, which was non-union, and other facilities around the country. So we, during our negotiations, we were able to, we intercepted some company, confidential company documents that indicated very strongly that Allied Signal was planning to close the Stratford plant and move manufacturing to Phoenix, Arizona, after it acquired the business. So they had a clause in this memorandum of understanding between the two corporations that Allied would not buy the business unless Textron negotiated a contract that was acceptable to Allied. So basically, Textron wanted to sell the business, Allied wanted to buy, and essentially we were had a veto power. So all of a sudden, it changed the leverage of the 1994 bargaining. From a very weak position that the union had, now all of, we found ourselves in a very strong position.
Sure.
We were not on strike. We, instead of the contract expired May 30th, we continued to work, which is unusual for us, the first time we've ever done that. And our tradition had always been, if we do not have a signed agreement as of the midnight on the date the contract expires, we're on strike, whether it was for a day or a two or in. The longest one was in 1970 against Apple Corporation. We were on strike for about 10 weeks. The we continued to work in 1994 on a day-to-day contract extension, and nothing changed. In other words, the wages, benefits, everything stayed as is. And Allied was in the back room. So they were prohibited from sitting directly at the bargaining table with us because they didn't own the business. And the rules of the Federal Trade Commission told them they had to stay at arm's length until the acquisition was consummated. We were negotiating with Textron management, and we were, our big issue was job security. He says, listen, we feel we're not going to sign a contract with you, and you're going to give us all these nice things, and a year later, we don't have a job. So that would be a fool's bargain, you know. At any rate, we, near the end, the company finally did agree. They said, listen, Allied Signal is going to need some help from the union to get some funding, because the Army has set up as what they call a Blue Ribbon Task Force in Washington to evaluate the future of the Stratford plant and the way they could preserve the tank engine industrial base that plant represented. It was unique and it wasn't duplicated anywhere else in the country. So the Blue Ribbon panel had recommended that they do preserve it and do several things. One is to bring more commercial work back into the Stratford plant. Another is they would come up to downsize the plant. They funded a package of funding proposals, and part of that was $6 million to downsize the plant. The plant was really a big 2 million square feet. It wasn't really very efficient or economical, and the volume of production made it a lot of overhead. So that was another of the recommendations. And the other was they had a program to overhaul all the tank engines, and they wanted to do it at Stratford. And these were particularly the most difficult engines to overhaul. There were real problems. So Allied, the text run says, listen, Allied really doesn't, you know, would like to stay here in Stratford. They're willing to commit, but they're going to need some help from the union. And they will agree to work out an agreement with you to keep this work here. There was six different engine models. They'll keep them here for at least the 3 years of the contract till 1997. And then we will we'll work with you, and we can make the plant viable, to change the methods of manufacturing. We'll stay here long term, indefinitely, and it'll be a win-win proposition. But we also need your help politically in Washington to help us get Congress to release this funding, approve the funding. So we said, fine, we agreed. We signed a contract with them in July of 1994. July 21st, it was ratified by the membership. And we had a side agreement, a comprehensive two. One was what we called an effects agreement. That dealt with problems that were going to flow from the sale of the business from Textron to Allied. We anticipated there would be further layoffs in 1995 when the Army procurement of tank engines was due to stop altogether.
Okay.
And there was a few, we were looking, Allied and Textron had been trying to develop some foreign market sales for the tanks to Egypt and Saudi Arabia, and there was one order that there were, the last order, the last 80 tanks went to the government of Kuwait. So we had agreed to sign what we called a competitiveness agreement. And it was almost a revolutionary document as far as we were concerned, considering our history, the militants, the confrontation, the wildcats. And we had agreed that during this time, I was the vice president, by the way. I had become the vice president in 1976, the vice president of the local. And my predecessor, Joe Soucy, who had been the president since 1976, he became president, I became vice president. He had some very serious health problems, and he was, and eventually he passed away in 1994, October 1st. That's when I became.
Okay, so you're saying you became president of the local in 94?
Yes, in 1994, October 1st. And the business, the sale was consummated on October the 28th, 1994. Allied Signal then took over the Stratford business. They bought it for $375 million from Textron. And as I say, we had signed this competitiveness agreement with Textron. And now Allied had assumed all the contracts, including this competitiveness agreement, where we committed to do a lot of things. There was a lot of, our experience was the plant was, manufacturing was very efficient.
Okay.
And we worked with management. Basically, they asked us, they said, listen, you guys know this business. We don't. We really need your help if we're going to be successful here. So we did. I set up a lot of committees. I got joint committees with the company representatives for reload, for quality, for cross-training of employees, safety, a lot of things that it was a mutual benefit. One of the things, one part of the business the company was planning to move to Phoenix was the repair and overhaul of the commercial engines. They had decided we're going to move that, and we'll keep everything else, but we're going to move that to Phoenix. The union got an agreement in 1994 negotiations that they wouldn't move it for a six-month period. And during that six-month period, they would agree to work with the union and see what we could do to make this more competitive, keep that commercial work here in Stratford. We looked at it, and they had a facility, Allied, or Textron, and then later Allied acquired a facility they had in England where they overhauled the, they also had an overhaul center for commercial engines. Because the engines, the commercial engines we were using was for a British plane, the Avro RJ, regional jet made by Avro, which was its predecessor was the British Aerospace Corporation. And each one of those planes used four of our engines, $1 million an engine. So it was a substantial business. The regional jet business is a very fast-growing part of the commercial market. And the planes usually carry about 70 to 80 passengers, and the engine, as I say, was a very good engine. We were not very competitive at all with the facility in Lutton, England, or Phoenix, Arizona. In other words, the planes, the operators would send the engines back to the factory periodically to be overhauled. And what's crucial to them is the time it takes to overhaul. But the plane is on the ground, they're losing money.
Sure.
So they did a study, and they came in and says, listen, in Lutton, England, and in Phoenix, it takes them about 60 days to get an engine back out to the customer. And they, about 500 hours of labor time. And they showed us, it took the Stratford plant, the average was 105 days, and the about 800 hours of labor. So we set up a committee, joint committee, to go through with management. We went through, we got a lot of data. We basically told them why they had these problems in Stratford, and we showed them how to fix it. And as a consequence, they got the turnaround time on an engine in Stratford down to about 30 days and with about 250 hours of labor. So they were substantially under the competitors. An example, what they used to do, an engine would come to Stratford. They would disassemble it. Our mechanics would disassemble it. They would take the parts, now the components, they sent down to a subsidiary, a division down in Greer, South Carolina. Greer, in turn, would take that part, and it would actually send it to a vendor up in Hartford, Connecticut, to do the actual work on it. So when it got up there, they usually, a lot of times, the plant in Hartford would call down for an engineer to go up and kind of give them some advice, technical advice, on what to do and how to fix the part. So, and then after they fixed it, remachine it, they would send it back to Greer. Greer then would send the part back to Stratford. So,
And you're like 50
right.
miles away.
So these are the kind of wasteful practices, business practices that we help them straighten out. And as a consequence, we were able to save jobs and more. We got much more work, repair and overall work, than we had been getting in the past. So. That's where we thought we were on the right track. In 1995, I got a call, in February of 1995, I got a call from Senator Lieberman's aide, military aide in Washington. He said, Dave, I'm going to give you some bad news. The Army has released a BRAC base closing list tomorrow, and they're putting this facility on the list. And that was no prior inclination that this was going to happen. So we had a lot of meetings. We had meetings with the Stratford Library. We formed a committee of citizens from the governor's office, Congresswoman DeLauro, Congressman Shays, Senator Dodd, Senator Lieberman, the union, a lot of utilities like the United Illuminating Company, to try to do what we could to make a presentation to the Army, to the BRAC Commission, a public presentation May the 5th in New York City. It was on the Carrier Intrepid Museum, where all the facilities in Connecticut, New York, and New Jersey, each facility had a lot of time to try to argue to get the facility off the list. At any rate, the commission voted, BRAC voted on June the 23rd after about 1 minute of, less than 1 minute of public debate to close the Stratford plant. And they said it was going to cost the taxpayers $2 million and over a 20-year period they're going to save $80 million. And they're going to take the production capabilities Stratford had and transfer it to Army depots in Anniston, Alabama for tank engines and to Corpus Christi, Texas for helicopter engines. And they could do all this for $2 million. So in the meantime, Allied Signal said, well, what are you going to do? Because there's an option and a provision in the BRAC law for these facilities to be privatized. And matter of fact, that's the Army and the military services encourage the privatization. That's the whole process of turning these mm-hmm. facilities over to private use. So we asked Allied Signal, well, we're prepared to work with you to work out a new lease arrangement with the local reuse authority, because the plant was eventually turned over, or would be turned over by the Army to the town of Stratford. And Allied took the position, well, no, we're going to close Stratford, we're going to move the production to Phoenix, Arizona. We're sorry, but we can save like $30 million. And I said, well, wait a minute. You have a contract with us. You committed to keep this work here for at least 3 years. You can't even make that decision until 1997. He said, well, you know, we don't think we have a binding contract, and this is not a what they call a mandatory subject of bargaining. We don't have to talk to you about it. So I filed a charge with the National Labor Relations Board. In late 1995, the company said, well, we're going to close and start beginning the closing. They were planning, working with the Army, to close the plant. The case went to trial. The National Labor Relations Board issued a complaint in July of 1996. I mean, the company violated the law, as it was not, failed to bargain with the union, and it had to bring the work back from Phoenix to Stratford. The company did not agree with that, so we had a trial. It was a very lengthy trial. Matter of fact, it was one of the longest trials on the National Labor Relations Board in Connecticut, in the National Labor Relations Board office up in Hartford, both Hartford and New York, before our administrative law judge, from September to the end of December in 1996. Judge issued a ruling a year ago, in April of 1997. He ruled basically in our favor, that the company had violated the law because they had refused to bargain with the union over this issue. It's a mandatory subject of bargaining, and they had to bring the work back, recall all the employees, and pay them full back pay, and then bargain with the union. So the company just issued a proclamation of innocence, said, well, we don't, as far as we're concerned, we're not in violation of the judge's order, and we're moving anyhow, which they did. And the plant, the layoffs began mass layoffs began in 1997. By the end of 1997, the local was down to about 130 people. The company, with the support of the Army, and the Army, by the way, what we have found out subsequently during the trial, we came across confidential company documents. And one of them in particular, what we call, referred to as the Culligan memo. Culligan, there was a vice president of Allied Signal Engines, Thomas Culligan, from their Washington office, the vice president of government affairs or something, sent this memo to Larry Bossidy, the CEO of Allied Signal, and a couple of other high-ranking Allied Signal officials. And this memo was dated February the 28th, 1995, the day before the BRAC notice. And it was almost gleeful. We found out that we've been put on the BRAC list, and this is going to give us an opportunity to close the Stratford for political cover. We can use this as, this will provide us political cover for a close to Stratford and relocate production to Phoenix, Arizona, and get the Army to pay for it. Now, keep in mind, Congress and the President and the BRAC said, they're going to close this for $2 million, and they're going to move it to the Army depots in Anniston, Alabama, and Corpus Christi, Texas. Nothing about Allied Signals plant in Phoenix, Arizona. But that's exactly what happened. They totally circumvented the law. The I wrote letters, Rosa Doro wrote letters. It's interesting that in the BRAC memo, in the Colligan memo rather, he said, we're probably going to be contacted by Senator Dodd, Senator Lieberman, and Congresswoman DeLauro about looking for ways to get the plant off the BRAC list. And our response, say nothing more than we are surprised. And he put surprise in quotation marks. I mean, this was a smoking gun. This was the whole plan. And we introduced it during the trial. And the company president they brought back from Europe to test it, the lawyers asked him about it, and he was turned red as a beet. He was totally flabbergasted. He denied it. Then he had to read it into the record. you know, and that was just one of many, many incriminating documents that we uncovered. Our agreement in this competitive agreement, when the company asked us to support their request for funding, that was their only out. There was a clause in this section 6 of this agreement that if they did not receive the funding, the standby funding for tank engine production, in the next federal budget hereafter enacted. Now that was signed in July of 1994. Next federal budget begins October 1st, 1995. We were clearly talking about the 1995 budget. The Congress did approve $47.5 million. So we filled all the commitments of the contract. We said to the company, you have no basis for terminating this contract. The company tried to argue, they did argue during the trial that, well, it wasn't just 1 year funding, it was any year. And unfortunately, in that particular part of the case, the judge, as sometimes they do, said, well, both sides, both the union and the company, had an equally plausible interpretations of this Section 6, so I'm calling it a draw. Our lawyers and the government lawyers were absolutely flabbergasted, and that's being appealed by the National Labor Relations Board.
Well, yeah, it's a draw, but it lets them do what they want to do.
In the meantime, what we did, we got into bargaining last spring for the contract, which expired in last June of 1997. And starting in April, the company came to the bargaining table with a new argument, very ingenious. Said, well, we have made a tentative decision to close Stratford and relocate production to Phoenix. Not a permanent decision. We're prepared to bargain with you over this decision. Well, has this decision got anything to do with the case you just lost? Oh, no, this is a new one. This is totally unrelated to that. This is because we have discovered that we have excess capacity. Not in Stratford, but in Phoenix. And we can consolidate all this production into one under one tent in Phoenix, Arizona, the non-union plant.
The non-union
naturally,
tents,
lower
yeah.
wages, lower benefits. We had documents showing there was at least a $3 or $4 an hour wage differential, saying nothing about benefits, pensions and things that we had that they didn't in Phoenix. So the company, during 1997, we bargained with them, attempted to bargain with them. And the law requires both parties to bargain in good faith and in order to try to avoid being charged with unfair labor practice, failing to bargain in good faith. So they went through the motions, and it's like telling us, listen, we're moving because we don't like the traffic on I-95, but union will be prepared to bargain with you over that issue. If you can do something about that, we'll reconsider this so-called tentative decision. And that was the sophisticated evasion of the National Labor Relations Act. So we went through this farce for 2 months. Finally, in June, the contract expired last June the 6th. June the 13th, they marched in. That day, in the afternoon, we were supposed to have a meeting to discuss the economics. The union had made proposals, concessionary proposals. So listen, we can up to as much as $25 million. We showed them how they could save by staying here in Stratford, including wage concessions, up to, you know, substantial wage concessions, things like benefits. And but we knew no matter what they did, they were not going to stay. It was just a farce. They were not interested in staying in Stratford because they got the Army to pay up to $100 million to pay for the relocation of their of this business to Phoenix, Arizona. Yes. And so they came in, marched in on June the 13th last year and said, well, Union Local 1010, we're no longer going to talk to you about this decision bargaining anymore. Our decision is now final. You have made, you had not been able to address our needs of excess capacity in Phoenix. So we're declaring the bargaining is over. We're at a bargaining impasse. Well, we're just going to implement it, and we'll see you later.
Great.
So we tried to get a, under the law, under the National Labor Relations Act, as a provision, Section 10J, we filed for an injunction with Washington, with the General Counsel. Last June, within a week or two, a couple weeks after that. I went down in October of 1997. I met with the General Counsel and the National Labor Relations Board in Washington with our attorney and Regional Director of the UAW here in Connecticut. And we met for about 3 hours. We went over the whole case. They grilled us. They put us through the paces, told them what it was all about. And they seemed to be very, very supportive of us. They knew we had got screwed. And we were able to prove it. We were able to show by documents, company documents, Army documents. And but there was a lot of political pressure on the board to back off by these various corporations were putting political pressure through the Republicans in Congress. Gingrich and the crew. As a matter of fact, the year before that, they had cut the National Labor Relations Board's federal budget by 30%. And that was trying to get them to back off using injunctions against employers, some of the worst employers, Caterpillar, the Detroit newspapers that had a long strike.
Yeah.
As a consequence, they were able to checkmate the union. And the board, because of this kind of pressure, and that General Counsel did not act. We went down again in December of that year, or last year, and basically what the board was trying to do to avoid trying to making a ruling on this case, obviously reluctant to do, it was trying to broker, well, why don't you and the company sit down and work something out? So we'll be happy to, but they have already closed the plant. Our bargaining leverage has been totally eroded, which is illegal. Yeah. And the board, says, well, what do you want from us? As a matter of fact, there was an article in the paper about 2 months ago where the General Counsel submitted his letter. He withdrew his nomination to President Clinton for a reappointment as General Counsel because of the political pressure by Trent Lott and all the Republicans that were responding to the employers,
sure,
to get them to back off of injunctions. So that's where we're at. The company, with that, the case is still pending on appeal. The company, to ratchet up the pressure on the union, the effects bargaining agreement, which we had negotiated in 1994, that provided severance pay, 45 hours pay for each year's service. It provided 6 months of medical for anybody laid off. It provided for 2 years of tuition assistance for people laid off or retired. They canceled that in June. And so we've had about 500 Local 1010 members laid off since last June without any severance, without any of these benefits. So that's, the company says, well, if you withdraw your legal case, we'll be prepared to consider re-implementing this or something to it. And so last September, this past January, I said, well, what are you prepared to do? You tell us what you'll do, and we'll consider it if we can negotiate a settlement. He said, well, you withdraw your case, and when we'll talk. It doesn't work. Put something on a table that I can take back to the membership. We're at a stalemate over that right now.
Essentially, they're saying, withdraw your case and we'll talk to you.
Yeah,
and maybe
trust us. We already screwed you. and it's true, we have the Army, there was an audit by the Army in 1996. The Army Inspector General audited the BRAC process. Because of Rosa Duaro, we provided Rosa with all the information. It says, Rosa, they're stealing this factory from Stratford, Connecticut. They ought to be in jail. And we sent provided all the documents to Congresswoman Doro. That's the plant is in her district. And she worked with Senator Dodd and Senator Lieberman, and they requested an Army audit. The Army came back and substantiated that the Army, basically most of the claims that we made, although they really lowballed the cost. They said, well, it's instead of $2 million, it's $9.8 million. But they Allied never submitted an estimate of the cost to relocate. And they never ever dealt with the issue of where this work was going. It wasn't supposed to. Congress didn't approve it to go to Phoenix. So that audit, when that came out, as critical as that was of the Army and Allied, it wasn't enough. So Senator Dodd, Senator Lieberman, sent a letter to the Department of Defense Inspector General, which is a higher level in the military bureaucracy, and they asked for another audit. Let's just look at the Army said, the Department of Defense says, yes, we agree with you, but nothing was ever done. This was over a year ago. The some Assistant Secretary of Defense finally sent me a letter, because I sent a letter to Secretary of Defense Perry, and he sent through the chain of command, some Assistant Secretary of the Army sent me a letter in October of 1996, and well, our cost estimates now are $23 million, which is 10 times what, and he disregarded that. We know that the costs are well over $100 million. And then where the Army used to get $4 million a year rent from for productive plant. Use of the factory, the machinery in the plant, now, after they vacated it, Allied found that there was another little goodie there, that they got what they called an idle facilities contract. The Army paid them $4.25 a square foot for all idle space to, quote, maintain it. So they were getting, instead of the Army getting money, now they were paying Allied Signal for over 700,000 square feet, about $3.5 million a year. So Allied, listen, the quicker we get out of here, the more we're going to make money at it. Sure. We're getting money from an empty factory in Stratford. And we got the Army
paying
for the total relocation. The Army built them a brand new facility. One component of the tank engine is what they call a recuperator. Every engine needs them, or a critical part of the engine. They recirculate all the gases. And they had a special building was housed in Stratford, Building 10. It had a huge Minster press, big press, laser welding machines, very complicated, involved process. Allied got the Army to build them a new factory, a new facility down in Anniston, Alabama, for their exclusive use to relocate. And the Army cost about $15 million to build and transport all that production equipment for recuperators down in Anniston, Alabama, which was in violation of the law, the Breck law. The Army also agreed to turn over all the tooling, hundreds of millions of dollars of tooling for all the engines, the tank engines, the helicopter engines. Just gave it to Allied Signal. And that tooling, particularly the helicopter engines, can be used to make commercial products, the commercial engines. So at any rate, that's
where we are as of right
that's
now?
That's where we're at right now. The plant, we are down to about 30 local 1010 employees, including myself. And the plant will be totally closed. It's anticipated by the end of September. Right now there's no production. All the machinery was sold at auction the first of the year. The plant's a huge, empty building. It's very depressing to have to go in there every day. A lot of ghosts,
yeah,
a lot of years, a lot of people.
Oh, maybe on a slightly more upbeat.
Yeah.
I just would like a little bit of, while you were doing all this stuff with the union,
okay,
you had mentioned earlier that you had gone back to school.
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about that and your experiences outside of the shop?
I was married. I have three children, two daughters and a son. I lived in Stratford with my wife. She was worked off and on, not too much, you know. Jobs maybe for a year here. Most of the time she stayed home and with the children, raised the children. During the 19, I was entitled to the GI Bill. So I went back to school at Housatonic Community College, I think in 1968. And I started out, I think I was getting like $15 a month under the GI Bill. But by the time by 1973, 74, with all the increases because of the war in Vietnam, and actually by the time I graduated in 1975, I was getting about a little over $300 a month. Now, during this period of time, there was no overtime at all in the plant. So this almost became a part-time job. I use it to live on. And I did get I graduated from Housatonic in 1972, and I transferred to Sacred Heart, and I graduated. I got my bachelor's degree in history at Sacred Heart in 1975. And we had, in 1992, we had negotiated a tuition reimbursement plan with AFCO Corporation, and very, very few of the bargaining people took advantage of that. They were working, they had good jobs, making good money. Not too many of them were motivated to go to college. So when I had 1985 negotiations, the company had come to us and said, listen, nobody's using it, this benefit plan, unless they want to use it, we're going to take it away. We don't think you need it. We said, oh, no, you're not. I said, well, we'll guarantee you're going to get some utilization. And I had been talking to a professor up at Yale. Somebody told me to go see this. Fellow by the name of Dave Montgomery on labor history, and I had been thinking about going back to school for a graduate degree. And that's what I did. I went back. I got accepted into Yale, and I got my master's degree in history in 1989. So
that's great.
Look at that. I'm an overeducated, unemployed local union president.
I want to thank you for this. This was extremely interesting. I guess before we wrap it up, as I mentioned earlier, this is going to sit in our archives forever.
Sure. Yeah.
If there are any words of wisdom or to posterity or your grandchildren you'd like to leave us with?
No, I can't think of it. Just my personal feelings that I say going into the plant every day, an empty plant. I've been there for 40 years. It's very difficult when I know what happened, when I see what happened. And some people ask me, well, you lost the battle. Does it? How do you feel about it? And of course, I don't feel good. But I think my whole life has been struggle, fighting, and you never lose the fight for the things that you believe in. And I'm sure at some point, I have confidence that somewhere down the line, that we will prevail. It's a long, frustrating process, and that's the way things are. And I would hope that this country will not turn its back on the trade union movement in such a way. So what's going on today with the corporate profits and the stock market booming, and everybody thinks that the unions are irrelevant. But in my opinion, they're needed more than ever. And I think I've had a life well spent in a very rewarding in the trade union movement.
Thank you.
Okay.